time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
What I'm hoping to see is just a clean repeal of the spending cap, because there's no need for the spending cap for our schools any longer, and there hasn't been for a long time.
We have reports, and I'm still waiting for the final, and the Attorney General's investigating it, that there was envelopes with zero signature on there, and it got approved as a good signature. There's no signature there. You can't tell me that wasn't with intent to defraud by saying, yeah, it's good, and just clicking the yes box and sending it on and counting the vote.
Behind me are illegal immigrants that were just dropped off on the Mexico side of the border. And here they are crossing into America. The invasion is well underway. I will surge National Guard troops to the border and we will finish the wall.
Arizona provides a really important framework for Senator Sinema's refusal to get rid of the filibuster and pass two common sense voting rights pieces of legislation in the Senate. And that's to say that Arizona is ground zero for the fight for access to the ballot.
And with us to talk about Senator Sinema and the filibuster, whether action will be taken on the state's education spending cap and more, are Lorna Romero of Elevate Strategies. Lorna, good morning.
Good morning.
And Chad Campbell of Strategies 360. Chad, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Chad, of course, as we like to do whenever you're on the program, we like you to speak on behalf of Senator Sinema. So let's start with that. The decision that she made, which was not a surprise, to not vote to change the filibuster and, in essence, killing the John Lewis Voting Act at this point, she's taken a lot of flack. Does she deserve some of it?
Well, I think that, you know, I think everybody has their own position on this, obviously, and the various organizations out there have their own goals and agendas attached to this, and their own mission. So I think they're all going to have approach to how they deal with Senator Sinema. What I would say, though, about this is, regardless of what side you fall on the issue, I think the one thing that people and a lot of these organizations continue to miscalculate when it comes to the senator and her position on this is why she's doing it. And people continue to believe that this is purely a political play by her. And I think that in her speech that she gave this week, she once again showed them that is not the case. This is something that she fundamentally believes in. She believes that if you begin to chip away at this quote unquote, you know, kind of guardrail for the Senate as an institution, that when the political power flips to the Republicans, which it could very well do so as early as next year, used against Democrats and used against groups that are in the extreme minority across the country. And so, you know, that's been her continued position on this. And we could argue whether or not that's right all day long. But for all these people attacking her and some of these groups and their tactics, again, I think that they need to recognize this is not a political play. And you know, I think she said this time and time again, she supports the Voting Rights Act. She's working on ways to figure out how to protect some ending the filibuster. But attacking her on political grounds is not going to sway her position on this, because that is not the basis of her position.
Lorna, understanding how emotional voters are, does Chad's point make sense? The fact that if Senator Sinema is consistent on this with a philosophy as opposed to doing it for purely political reasons, does that come across as better, and does that give her any political protection of any kind?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting dynamic, and I just want to first applaud Chad for threading that needle very nicely with his reaction to you, because it's been quite a firestorm within the Democratic Party this past week, especially against Kyrsten Sinema. You know, I do agree with Chad that this isn't a political tactic for the senator. She's been very clear and consistent about her position. And I think the politics is coming from the more progressive element of the party that was trying to publicly force her hand and try to change her mind publicly. And Chad's right. I mean, the filibuster rule pertains to any party who's in leadership. So, you know, by the end of this election cycle, if Republicans are successful in taking over, I think Democrats would want to maintain the filibuster. And so I think it's a really short-sighted play by the Democrat Party in general for attacking her. She's the greatest thing that's happened to the Democrat Party in Arizona in 30 years. She laid the groundwork for a successful statewide campaign for a Democrat. And then within 2 years, they want to throw that all away and blow it up. I just find it fascinating from the Republican side. And all they're doing is just making the Republican case against the Democrats even easier this election cycle.
Well, Chad, you talk about how this is something that Senator Sinema really believes in, and that, you know, we should point out that she was also a co-sponsor of the voting rights bills that the filibuster debate was over. Is there any reason to believe that she or anyone else in the Senate can work across the aisle to get anything on the issue of Voting Rights Act done before, you know, before the end of this year?
They can do it. It is Senator Sinema. I think she proved that with her work on the infrastructure package. You know, she crafted and led the negotiations for the most part on a historic infrastructure bill, that the biggest infrastructure investment this country has seen in decades. So I think there is proof that she can get this done. You know, now it's tougher on this because I think anybody on the Democratic side will admit or agree with me on this. The Republican caucus, for the most part, doesn't really have much incentive to support the Voting Rights Act, the elements in that bill. So it's a very tough road. But again, if anybody can do it, it is Senator Sinema, I believe. And I think she does have that track record of success in terms of working with some of her Republican colleagues, some of the more moderate Republican colleagues in the Senate. And so my guess is, and my assumption is, that she is working on that because she has stated it time and time again, as I mentioned earlier, she does support the legislation. She does think it's a critical issue, but she just, again, is unwilling to blow up the filibuster because she thinks the ramifications will come back to haunt not just Democrats, but haunt the country as a whole when the political power in the Senate flips, which it will happen at some point. It always does, as we all know. Partisan politics is very cyclical, and it goes back and forth in any given election cycle.
Well, so Chad, you said this is not a political move by Senator Sinema, but clearly there are political implications of it. We heard at the top of the hour a clip from CNN, Congressman Ruben Gallego, talking about basically never saying no to the future. He has been mentioned as a potential primary challenger. 2 years, of course, an eternity in politics. But do you, at this moment, if you had to guess, would you say that there will be a primary challenger to Kyrsten Sinema?
Yeah, there will be, I think. Who it will be and if they're viable is the question, though, but there definitely will be. But I think to your point about 2 years being an eternity in politics and going back to Lorna's earlier point, you know, I just have to point this out. When Senator Sinema was running for this office, excuse me, she was running when the Democrats were the minority, and she was very clear in her position that she was not going to end the filibuster. Democrats applauded her for that position, and that was just a couple of years ago. So the ever-shifting political landscape, it's so hard to predict for just 2 years from now. And you know, 2 years from now, if the Republicans do have control of the Senate, it may flip again. And Democrats may be very excited by the fact that the filibuster is in place and protecting their interests. So I think trying to have any conjecture on what the 2024 election cycle is going to look like is very difficult this time. I can't even figure out the March 2022 local election cycle right now in terms of predictions. So trying to get to 2024 is going to be very difficult, I think.
Well, Lorna, that's clearly not going to stop us from asking, despite the challenges of that. One of the things that we keep hearing about Senator Sinema is her favorability ratings among independents and even Republicans who think she's doing a good job. I guess the question here is, of course, without knowing who she would be running against in the election in 2024, assuming she makes it out of the primary, can you see a scenario where there would be Republicans who would actually vote for Kyrsten Sinema, even if they did so before, given the way that the political climate is now? Is this a block of voters she can reliably depend on?
I do think so. I think that's something that's a really crafted Kyrsten's leadership qualities, as she, even when she was in Congress. I mean, she represented CD9, which was a pretty competitive district, and just in terms of voter demographics, even though it was always a Democrat. But she's always been very representative of her constituents. And so her winning statewide in Arizona, that was only possible because of moderate Republican voters and independents who lean Republican voting for her against Martha McSally. And so she's made that very clear since she's been elected that she was elected to represent all of Arizona, not the progressive element of the Democrat Party. And I think that's what her Democrat colleagues are failing to recognize, is that she really is a consensus-driven leader, and that hasn't changed, and I don't think that's going to change. I think the issue is going to be, as she continues to get attacked by Democrats and looks vulnerable, Republicans are going to capitalize on it. So they're going to try to take that base away from her that did vote for her this past election cycle. So it does make her a little bit more vulnerable, but it's not impossible for her to maintain those voters, especially as she continues to lead the way that she has been. But her to be trying to fend off more progressive leaders that are going to primary her, try to make her look bad, potentially going into a general election. I think it's a really slippery slope for Democrats. I mean, if they get a progressive out of that primary, there's no way they're going to win statewide. And I also think it's fascinating that everyone's so focused on 2024 when we have 2022 right around the corner, and no one's really talking about Mark Kelly right now, which is the race that we need to watch. But I guess the strategy right now is all eyes on Sinema.
Well, we will talk about Mark Kelly probably in a little bit. But Lorna, let me ask you this from the standpoint. Yes, we know there are progressive groups that have said they want their money back from Senator Sinema, or they're not going to endorse her in the future. I'm going to flip it to you with, let's say, a similar Republican organization, at least in the past, Republican-leaning organization, let's put it that way. If I threw out Club for Growth or the NRA or something like that, and they were saying this about a Republican senator, let's say they had said this about Senator McCain, how would we observe that? Do those organizations still carry the heft these days, especially when it comes to money?
I mean, they have their spheres of influence, like every organization does. But I would not sit here and say that any group on the left or right is the end-all be-all of any candidate. If you lose one constituency, then you need to work harder to gain support elsewhere. And I mean, and this is the interesting dynamic with Kyrsten Sinema. We've seen this on the Republican side for decades now with our previous U.S. senators, with elements of the Republican Party or conservative wings of the party going against McCain and Flake in the past. And so, and yes, there was political ramifications for someone like a Senator Flake, but we saw with Senator McCain, he just carried on and did what he thought was right for the state. So, I mean, I would fully expect that that's what Kyrsten does. If these groups decide to pull their support, pull their money, she's just going to continue doing what she's fight for the voters of Arizona, not necessarily for progressive activist endorsements.
Chad, let me give Bob Robb's column a free plug. Not really sure why I'm doing that, but he said that Kyrsten Sinema could still run as an independent and still win in Arizona. I know too early to even think about that, but if you're an independent that would caucus with the Democrats, is that even possible in a couple of years?
Well, I mean, anything's possible. I don't think that's a likely scenario at the end of the day. Again, I think that Senator Sinema believes in what she's doing, and I think that she thinks, excuse me, in the long run, she's going to be proven right, and that, you know, the Democratic base and a lot of the Democratic groups out there will come back around. But, you know, that all remains to be seen. You can, if there's anybody who can run as an independent, it would be Senator Sinema, but I cannot see a scenario where that would happen. I, you know, she's a Democrat. I don't think there's any, I know some people are questioning that, but I don't think that's true. And if you look at her voting record, it's definitely not true. She votes the administration, votes their caucus almost all of the time and voted against Donald Trump a lot of the times. So I think she will be a Democrat. I don't see that changing. I think that trying to speculate in 2024 is very difficult right now. I think it'll depend on how the rest of this year goes and the outcome of this election, Lorna's point. I think a lot of people are just kind of glossing over 2022, which is fascinating to me.
That is Chad Campbell. Also with us is Lorna Romero. And with Mark Brody in Phoenix, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is the Friday Newscap, and we'll continue after this. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests this morning are Lorna Romero of Elevate Strategies and Chad Campbell of Strategies 360.
All right, Lorna, we're going to talk about the 2022 elections for at least a couple of minutes here. With a new entrant into the congressional race, State Senator Kelly Townsend is going to be running for Congress from a district, basically a southern and south eastern Arizona type district. We should point out that this is not where she lives, although it is not required that you live in your district to run for Congress. It's in the past, this area has kind of been seen as a bit of a swing district. A lot of folks are saying it's, you know, could be competitive again this year. What do you make of her deciding to not run for re-election, which would put her in a primary against a colleague, Wendy Rogers, but instead run for Congress?
You know, I think obviously with the shifting of the legislative and congressional districts to the IRC, it really caused, I think, everybody who was eyeing elected office for this upcoming to evaluate. And so for someone like Kelly Townsend to potentially be running against Wendy Rogers, which they're very much aligned and friendly, you know, I think she went ahead and looked at, you know, could she better serve elsewhere? And her determination was to look at that congressional seat, which a lot of Republicans think that we can take that seat. And so obviously with her newer found popularity with the Trump camp and whatnot, I'm sure she just looked at the analysis and decided that was the right decision for her. You know, I can't speak for her personally, but I just think different than what we're seeing from any candidate, Republican or Democrat, when it comes to their political calculations for 2022.
Yeah, she got a shout out from the president at his rally in Florence last weekend. Does it matter that she doesn't live there? I mean, she talked about how, you know, she spends a lot of time in that area, but she doesn't live there. Does that matter anymore in these races?
You know, it'll matter to some, and, you know, and people will try to mention that, you know, they don't actually live in, they're a carpetbagger, they don't live in the district. But I mean, there's so many congressional leaders at this point that don't. And so I think the effectiveness of that has waned off. It's really going to be about the messaging that and how you can resonate to the voters in that district. I mean, I think it's hard if you live in Central Phoenix in a high rise and you're trying to run in Mojave County. Yeah, that might be a difficult a transition for you to make. But I mean, she does represent an area of the Far East Valley, you know, Apache Junction, which is a little bit more of a rural feel. So it might not be that far off in terms of what's going to be top of mind for voters. But I mean, someone will mention that she doesn't live in the district. But at the end of the day, I don't know how much it's going to matter.
Chad, because we always love to have you opine on internal Republican politics. What does her entrance do to the Republican primary down there? And maybe what would that do to the general election as well? There's obviously a number of other candidates already running on both sides.
Yeah, with the fact that it doesn't really matter where Kelly lives because she doesn't live in reality. So it doesn't really matter which district she's running in. I think that's irrelevant at this point. And I also want to throw out there, you know, her and Wendy Rogers, I mean, I would have loved to have seen that campaign. I would love to have seen which one of them would have gotten JFK Jr. to be their campaign chairperson. So it's unfortunate that that didn't pan out for the Arizona voters and the entertainment that would have given us. But I think that, you know, ultimately, for the Democratic perspective, that we would love to see Kelly Townsend in a general election in that district. It's a competitive district, leans just slightly Republican. And it goes back to the conversation we were just having a minute ago at the statewide level on the Democratic side. You can't go too far left yet in Arizona. And in a district like this, if you're on the Republican side, you can't go too far right. And again, other than Wendy Rogers, there's nobody down at the Capitol that I would say is further right and further down the conspiracy rabbit holes than Kelly Townsend. So I think she would be a dream candidate from the Democratic perspective in a general election.
Well, and Lorna, we've got, because we had to mention Wendy Rogers a couple of times, let's talk about how much money she has raised, which is incredible for a legislative race, no doubt, because of her support of the so-called Stop the Steal, the so-called ballot audit, that sort of thing. President Trump, obviously, a fan of hers as well. Granted, each party has people that are, let's say, not in the mainstream of their party, although for a lot of people, maybe Wendy Rogers looks more and more like the mainstream. Is it troubling at all that she raised this kind of money?
It's very impressive. I mean, for somebody who's been looking at legislative races for a long time, and I'm sure Chad can his time being at the legislature, I remember when people would win, you know, legislative races with only $15,000 in their campaign account, et cetera, and now to be raising millions of dollars. And especially nowadays, you know, with so much outside money coming in, going into these races too, individual candidates really are now feel like they have to raise. So yes, she capitalized on it. I think any candidate would. I mean, if you have access to, even more supporters and potential donors. I don't care what level of an elected official you are, you're going to capitalize on that and raise money. And so she did it, and good for her. And I mean, we've seen the same opportunity. Katie Hobbs capitalized on the fact of everything that was happening with the audit and raised money off of it too. So, I mean, you see it in any level, any kind of party affiliation. And so good for her. I just hope that it's not the norm these days that now all of a sudden legislative races are going to be costing millions and millions of dollars because that's what people are raising. It's a one-off for everyone's sake, or else things are going to get really expensive in Arizona, even more expensive very soon.
Yeah, Chad, is that potentially troubling? And as a secondary question to that, how much of the money do you think, are we going to find that Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, gave a lot of money to Wendy Rogers?
I'm sure. Again, I mean, this is the conspiracy world that some of that party now lives in. And I do think that's the problem here. I want to say this. I think raising money off of proven lies that threaten democracy is not a good thing to be doing. I mean, Lorna, I appreciate what you're saying, but, you know, Katie Hobbs raised money off of defending the facts and defending a fair election, whereas Wendy Rogers and that whole crowd is raising money off of literally trying to undermine our democracy. And that is very, very dangerous. And quite frankly, it's a big con to voters. It's a big grift. They're learning from their master, Donald Trump. And it reminds me that the years ago when there was a bill at the legislature that wanted to ask people to privately donate to building a border wall. And that was the most ridiculous thing ever. And a bunch of, you know, people who believed in border security gave over their hard-earned dollars, and it never went anywhere, and they lost their money. So this is troubling because of that fact that people are raising money off of things that threaten our democracy. And it really does bother me. And it's being funded, to your point, by this people like this MyPillow guy. There was another article I just saw yesterday about the owner of, I think it's Uline Distribution, another billionaire that's funding all of these stolen election organizations. This is very troubling because I've said this on this program repeatedly. We are on the verge of losing our democracy over the next several years if we don't pay attention. This is what happened in Turkey. This is what happened in Hungary. This is what happens in countries all across the world. And democracy is a very fragile thing. And I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here, but it is. And we're still a relatively young country in the grand scheme of human history. And people think we have democracy locked in. It's forever, but it isn't. We have to fight for it. And I think there's a lot of people and a lot of interests out there trying to undermine that with a lot of money.
Lorna, just a few minutes left, and I want to ask you about one of the bigger issues at the Capitol, at least among some lawmakers right now, which is this looming deadline to raise or eliminate the spending cap for K-12 schools. If this doesn't happen, we've been told that schools could lose an awful lot of money that they had already been allocated. Superintendent of Public Instruction Kathy Hoffman came on the show this week to talk about why she thinks this needs to happen. Is there any momentum for this at the Capitol? Obviously, it needs a vote of Republicans and Democrats to get this done. Is there any amount of confidence that this will happen at the moment?
You know, obviously it's top of mind and a conversation that's happening down there. I don't see a scenario where the legislature is going to force by inaction or for schools to have to cut budgets so close to the end of the school year. I don't. Is this a very political issue? Yes, because of everything that's happened recently with Prop 208, the ongoing litigation, there's a number of different factors involved. So it's really going to take some real conversations with community and leaders down there to come to some type of agreement. I think they will reach it. And I think the conversation about just the aggregate limit in general, I'm sure this was brand new information to a number of those members down there that we even had this in the state, in the Constitution. I mean, one, we have just a number of new members because of resignations and whatnot. But two, I mean, it hasn't been something that they had to deal with for a while. So I think something will get resolved, but it's going to require some negotiation overall K-12 education funding. That's just the reality.
Chad, do you share Lorna's optimism, especially as she referenced Prop 208? There are some Republican members who are saying that they need some concessions on that.
Yeah, I think ultimately something will get done. I guess the devil's in the details, right? Will the Republicans, or at least some of them, try to leverage this for voucher expansion, for more privatization in general? I think that's the biggest concern for most of us on the Democratic side. And ideally, we'd see this as a very clean approach, you know, lift this cap, address this very archaic rule that, you know, quite frankly, is going to hamper not just our school funding, but our entire economy in the long run. It's a very arbitrary spending limit that makes no sense and should not be part of our budgetary process. So I would hope that it'd be a clean process. I'm not optimistic about that. I am optimistic that something will be done because I think something has to be done. But the concern is what are going to be the ancillary things that the Republicans try to attach to this, and how much damage will it do if they're successful?
And Lorna, briefly taking us back a week and a half to the governor's State of the State address, though he has said this is a legislative issue to handle, were you surprised he didn't bring it up in a State of the State address? Lorna, are you with us? Chad, what do you think?
Oh. I can fill in for Lorna.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding. I wasn't surprised necessarily. You know, again, I think that it's going to be a very controversial subject for some of the Republican legislators down there. So my guess is that the governor probably didn't want to bring it up in the State of the State when it's going to be something that creates some internal strife with his own caucus. So probably thought it was best to leave that out of the speech. And from a strategist perspective, he probably wasn't wrong. I would have liked to have seen it, but I don't necessarily blame him from a purely political perspective.
And Lorna, we still have a few seconds. What do you think about the governor not having that in his State of the State?
You know, I'm not surprised by it. I mean, he had a jam-packed agenda with all of his priorities for the upcoming year. Not to say that making sure that schools are fully funded for the end of the rest of the school year is not a priority of his, but the fact that he doesn't even get to sign the bill, I just think it's action by the legislature. I think his team will be involved in those conversations and negotiations, but it's a complicated issue, and I'm sure it just would have confused people if he mentioned it in the State of the State. So I don't think that's any sign of his lack of engagement on this topic whatsoever.
Okay. Lorna Romero of Elevate Strategies. Lorna, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Chad Campbell, Strategies 360. Chad, take care.
Yeah.